Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Aside from the Warren Commission, there is only one other investigative body that was specifically dedicated to the Kennedy assassination, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which was established in September of 1976 and wrapped up in the early days of January 1979. In this bonus episode of Solving JFK, we'll be speaking with Robert Tannenbaum, who has a unique perspective on the HSCA. For a period of time, he ran the day-to-day operations of the investigation into the Kennedy assassination as deputy chief counsel. Before that, Tannenbaum was an assistant district attorney focused on homicide in New York City, where he never lost a felony trial. After his time on the HSCA, Tannenbaum was a law professor at UC Berkeley, served 2 terms as mayor of Beverly Hills, and has written 33 books. His newest book, That Day in Dallas, gets into the details of his time on the HSCA. Was the HSCA a real investigation, or were there political or parapolitical motives that were more important than pursuing the truth? We'll hear what Bob Tannenbaum has to say coming up next on Solving JFK.
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a patsy.
The man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
Mr. Tannenbaum, it's an honor to have you here with us on Solving JFK.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Obviously, I'm very interested in your whole career. You're a super interesting guy. I've got a ton of questions to ask you about the HSCA and your time on it. So I guess just to start, and by the way, I've just finished reading your book, That Day in Dallas. Very, very, very good book. And you really get into your time on the HSCA in that book. Can you talk a little bit about how you were initially hired to be on the HSCA and then what your job was like as deputy chief counsel?
Well, yes, very interesting to me is that in my career in the DA's office, where I had prosecuted to verdict, that is, pick the juries, opening statements, cross-examination, summations, and then that's what I mean when I say try a case. So I prosecuted more cases than anybody else, except for one person, Richard A. Sprague, who was the chief, he was a deputy chief in Philadelphia. He was Mr. Pennsylvania. Anyone had a serious case, they went to Richard Sprague. He had tried more, prosecuted more cases than I. And I can tell you what an outstanding human being he was, because here's what happened. I had no inkling or knowledge about what was going down anywhere else because I was flooded with no lesser plea cases, trying to get disposition. And I was still trying murders. It was all part of the whole package. I loved it. Every day was a new, exciting day as far as I was concerned. And so what happened was in October of 76, Richard A. Sprague was designated, I didn't know anything about this, He was designated chief counsel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And that, it was twofold. One assassination issue for one subcommittee was who murdered JFK, and that was a separate investigation. The other investigation was the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. I mean, talk about two incredible Americans. So without my knowing it, Sprague had done an investigation on me. And he called me up and he said he would like me to come to Washington with him. This is out of the clear blue, and I would take over the Kennedy investigation. And he would work with me on it. Well, I checked around who he was and so on and so forth. Friends of mine said, "You guys are the perfect pair. You'll work 18 hours a day, he'll work 18 and a half hours a day. So you don't have to worry about anything." But we met and we agreed that we need to hear from the committee themselves that they are not going to interfere politically with what is going on. We're not going down there with any brief. We're not going down there because someone said that there was a CIA or anything else. I'll get to that in a second. But we were going down there to see what the evidence said. And whatever the evidence said, we, of course, will submit it to the committee. This is a congressional committee. It wasn't a Sprague committee. It wasn't a Tannenbaum committee. And that we would tell the American people the truth, what we found. And we ran down every rabbit hole you can run down with respect to other potential characters in this whole scenario, LBJ, the mafia, et cetera, et cetera. So that was acceptable to the committee. They said they would definitely not create a political atmosphere here. It took us 4 months to realize they were lying, and it became very apparent. And here's what happened. My first week, literally in Washington, this is now 77 in January. I got a telephone call from Senator Richard Schweiker, who was in charge of the Senate committee investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy, and the response of the intelligence executive offices, how they responded to all this, how this could have happened without anyone really knowing it, and so on. So it was an introspection also about the assassination and the executive intelligence agencies that should have been on top of this whole thing, and in fact weren't. So what happened was, Church asked me to come and see him first week in Washington. And of course I did. And Senator Richard Schweiker, who was a conservative, middle-of-the-road Republican, he wasn't looking for a press conference. He wasn't looking to make a name for himself here by saying crazy things for which there was no evidence. He said, I want to tell you two things, both of which are very, very difficult for me to deal with because of your, I know your background," he said. "You're around the Homicide Bureau, you're around the criminal courts in the DA's office, and you try. Everyone knows you're a fanatic. You try all these cases." And he said, "Oh, I do want you to know this. The CIA will totally try to deceive you. They did everything they could to obfuscate our investigation on the Senate side." I'm sitting in his office in a club chair listening to this. He said, "The second thing I want, and here are my notes." He said, "The second thing I want to tell you is, and this is gut-wrenching for me to tell you, the evidence in this case, as far as we're concerned here on the Senate side, is a result of this investigation." And remember, Church, Senator Church was the lead person in this whole investigation, which received tremendous amount of publicity at the time in the mid-70s. And he said, "From the evidence, I want you to know that we believe that the CIA murdered the president."
Wow.
I felt that 10 buckets of ice water had just been poured on my head. I said to him, "Only this is what the evidence tells you?" He said, "Yes." I said, "You understand that. I want to thank you for your time and your opinion, but we're not going down there to vindicate anything. You know that." He said, "Absolutely. You go where the evidence takes you." I said, "That's exactly what our mission is." Well, he was right. The CIA interfered with the investigation in its entirety. And an interesting thing happened. In 19, what was it, in 61, Alan Dulles was in charge of the Bay of Pigs fiasco, the invasion of Cuba in 1961. And it was a fiasco. The CIA was in charge of this. They had Richard Nixon approving it in 1959, the vice president. He was, of course, going to be elected. Everyone knew that he would beat JFK in the 1960 election, so they thought, wrongfully. And the president was very disturbed that he felt he got the wrong information about the entire invasion. And so JFK fired Allen Dulles. And, you know, this is the same Allen Dulles from the family of John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State. These were well-heeled people in influencing what was going on in our country. And so he replaced Allen Dulles with a very pro-lawyer JFK person. His name was John McCone. John McCone has come up with probably one of the most important pieces of evidence in the case. And that was to say that McCone and others in the government were very concerned that the public might find out. This was their concern. That the government, that the people of America might find out that Lee Harvey Oswald was a contract employee of both the FBI and the CIA since 1957. Oswald was at a Sugi Air Force base in Japan monitoring those U-2 flights. Gary Powers was the captain of one of those planes that got shot down. Well, our government was aghast to the extent that basically instead of dealing with other major issues that I'm going to get to in a second, that they figured there must be a mole because to get that plane up required very, very serious training, but to get it down as well was the reverse of that. And so they set Oswald up, who worked with Angleton, our American super spy, and he worked with Angleton, Oswald did. And they set Oswald up as someone now who was defecting. You remember this whole scenario. And it was a lie, but they wanted to get to the mole. And he said, I have important information. I just got to get it to the right people, all this kind of stuff. They never got the mole. But here's what happened, which I think you're going to find very fascinating. James Rowley was the chief of the Secret Service at the time. Rowley wrote a note to McCone, who was head of the CIA now since 61. And the letter to Rowley, which McCone wrote in response, was March 3rd, 64. March 3rd, 64. McCone responds to Larry. And McCone says, you know, we're concerned about leaks also about Lee Harvey Oswald because of people... you know, it had to do with his training and his suspect activity. And he said, McCone, that the leaks are very important because if anyone believes these leaks, the wrong persons, the leaks could lead the media to erroneously claim that the CIA and perhaps others were directly involved in the Dallas action. The Dallas action is how they refer to the assassination of President Kennedy. And then on page two, the top of page two of this three-page letter, third page is a signature page, McCone wrote the following. While the persons involved in the assassination were in the employ of this agency, the CIA, what, imagine that, what I'm telling you. This is evidence. While the persons involved in the assassination were in the employ of this agency, as well as the FBI, he brushes it aside and says, it's impossible to monitor and maintain 24-hour day responsibility over our agents. I checked out this document to make sure it was legitimate. It passed every test. It was found where it should have been found. The numbers on it were consistent with the numbers of the pages before and after. And the reason I mention this is because the government's initial reaction was, oh, that's a fake letter. It's a legitimate letter. It passed muster on every aspect of what we're talking about here. It was used in 1978, and it was used in 1991 in Russell's book, Dick Russell's book. So it's not something I found and no one else has had. It's been out there since 78. Yes, sir, go ahead.
So yeah, that the McCone Rowley memo, like what you just laid out, that document sort of confirms all of these other things that you sort of already know. But to your point, it is, I would say, disputed as a document. Now, the reason it's disputed is two reasons, okay? And so I'd like to kind of zoom in on that with you if I can. One of those reasons is they asked the National Archives where it was. The National Archives said they can't find it. Well, on that reason, strike that out. That is not a good argument because one of my friends, Canadian attorney Andrew Eiler, who's an expert in the JFK Records Act, went to the National Archives looking for these final determination forms from the ARRB. And long story short, he was there for 3 days and they couldn't find the thing that he asked for. But turns out it was in one of the boxes. It was labeled something different. So the fact that National Archives can't find something is meaningless in terms of ascertaining whether or not it exists. Their whole situation's a disaster. Also, there's a part of the ARRB that allowed agencies to turn documents over before the act was operational. And if they did that, then the documents would not be put in with the other JFK records. Okay, that part of it is not an issue. The other part that people hang on as an argument, and I just don't really know, is the it says like CO, like there's some sort of numbering on in the top right corner, and people say that's not consistent with CIA numbering. I really don't know, but what I do know is there's someone else who worked on the HSCA. I'm not at liberty to say this person's name. You know this person.
I have a tape from him. He found it and he covered every issue along with a Mr. Blunt, who was regarded as the best of all the researchers. They before I ever would talk about it, I went through every aspect, including all of these numbers and so on and so forth. First of all, who would lie about the content of this letter? It's another embarrassment of our government because there are at least one, two, three, four areas where they knowingly lied that are provable, and I'll get to in a second, but go ahead. No, I think it's important to have this discussed and let out.
On this document, there's another person who basically told me, I know that the McCone rally document is real because I was there and I saw it with my own eyes. And I obtained a copy of it for myself. And I don't want to go on the record because I could be held, criminally liable because of that. And so my question is, did you see it with your own eyes at the HSCA or you came across it later?
Oh no, I did not see it with my own eyes. It was described to me in accuracy. I said, explain to me how you would know it was real or not real. And they went through this with me. And they talked about all the numbers. These are serious people here. These are people who had nothing else to do, and they found the document, and it was a phony, and it just so happens to be a major admission by the head of the CIA. Why, by the way, nothing ever happened with the CIA, seriously dealing with this thing. They have conducted themselves in a shameful manner throughout. Now, one other quick thing I want to mention to you about the HSCA, why it became a sham. On page 37 of the Forensic Medical Panel report, page 37, the Forensic Medical Panel report for the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Chief of the staff there writes the following. These are people who took over after Sprague and I left. First thing they did was hire CIA people to conduct this investigation. Well-known CIA agents and operatives. And in it, at page 37, the chief of staff and is responsible for all this says that the Parkland doctors must have been mistaken. When they say they saw the opening in the back of the president's head, that's the fourth shot. It hit him from the front area away into the area of the stockade fence. So there was not someone wasn't directly in front of him on Elm. It came from the side of the, and the limo hadn't passed that area yet. And that's how JFK gets hit, right in the temple area, and it blows the back of his head out. And Bobby Sargas, who was on his motorcycle, gets hit with blood, brain, and other matter coming out of JFK's head. And the witnesses then run, all in the book, all in the book. They run to the area where they said that shots were being fired over their head from the stockade fence. They're in the line of fire, they said. Some of whom covered their children. They were worried they were going to get shot. And so, what is the truth about this? Keep in mind what I just read to you. The staff, the senior CIA staff who took over when we left, said the Parkland doctors must be mistaken about the evulsive head wound because all of the 26 witnesses at Bethesda said they did not see the evulsive head wound. The truth, about what I just told you. And this comes from the lips of those people who just referred to by this lie. And that was the very 26 witnesses who allegedly didn't see this, not only saw the whole gaping hole, they reported it under oath to the committee, the very committee that is now alleging this situation. That is, you know, the Alan Dulles thing, the single bullet theory, this forensic medical panel thing, and NAA. Keep in mind, when NAA came out, neutron activation analysis, the head of our committee here, now run by the CIA, said, hey, you know what? Now, if you guys persist in contradicting us, we have science, so you must believe the Earth is flat. This is exactly what they said, knowing that the metallurgical PhDs in our country said this whole thing is a sham and it's invalid. So, you know, and let me tell you about a piece of evidence in this case that is dynamite, talking about evidence here. It's not just a letter that they could come on. And again, I want someone to tell me, putting aside all the numbers, everything formed, everything matched. And I know well the person who found this thing. And very, very good person, very good person. But here's the issue that I wanted to mention to you. There are a couple of them. The first is what we call minute metallic fragments, which you've heard about. If I was shot in the back of the head now, there would be no minute metallic fragments in the front of my head. So what do we have in this case? We have minute metallic fragments inside JFK's head, at the right side of his head. And I would encourage everybody to get a hold of these three skull x-rays that show it. It's a rectangle, and it goes from front to back. And they superimpose JFK's face on it. It's very worthwhile. You must see it. And what it does is two things. It tells us the direction of the head wound, and it tells us the point of entry. Totally consistent with JFK's motorcade moving forward, and geographically from the front, he gets hit right in the side of the head. His head snaps back. Now, as far as that goes, I must tell you the following, with his head snapping back. The shot that hit, that there were three shots. There were two flurries of shots. The first three shots, all of the scene witnesses, who are very important in the case, people pass them off because they don't try cases. They don't know what they're talking about. And what's important about the flurries is that witnesses can be very invaluable, even though they don't say that I saw the defendant with the gun and I can identify him in a lineup. That's when they think they're important. Here in this case, they said the first flurry of shots happened very quickly. And I clocked it all because I had the ability to be involved with immutable evidence, scientific, acoustical, visual, and acoustics, which people weren't really available at the time of this all. And they said the first flurry had two or three shots. Turns out it was three shots from science, and it took 2.6 seconds. Then they said there was a pause. They didn't know how long. They didn't have a stopwatch. 4.8 seconds, we know. And the fourth shot was a boom blast, and it came from the stockade fence, Knoll Hill area. And the people on the bridge, like Mr. Holland and his staff people, they all turned to their left. And that's when I said the people who were around hit the deck, felt they were in the line of fire with shots coming over their head. But here's the key to this thing. And this is where, put everything else aside. If JFK was hit in the rear, you know what JFK's head did when he was shot? He finally snapped back and to his left and leaned in his wife's right shoulder. And he was bodily depressed. He was slumped, dead, and immobile. Now, you're teaching a class in this. Totally in good faith, knowledgeable. You ask your classmates, when someone is shot in the back of the head, how does the head go backwards? The government's position was there were only three shots, two of which hit the president, one in the head and one in the back. The one in the back we know is a total sham because that's the one that had a downward declination, a downward track. It somehow goes vertically up his body, out his throat. And still fractures the axial nerve, but shows no damage, no deformity. That's the single bullet theory, by the way. And so what we have here is, we know from watching frame 313, Zapruder frame 313 shows the hit to Kennedy's head and the blast that flares out of his head being blown up. Well, how does the head go backwards if the three shots the government's telling us all came from the rear? So you know what the government did? There's no end to the lying of the CIA. They gelatinized 10 skulls to replicate human skulls. And they fire from the same height as the window in the depository, the so-called sniper's nest window, and the height and the rifle, the Malika Calcano. And they fire 10 times. Which direction do you think the skulls moved? They all moved forward. They were shooting from the back. They moved forward. In other words, in this case, watch the head movement. It's not the body moving the head. It's the head moving the body. That's what is going on here. And at frame 313, we see that shot coming from the stockade fence. There was a fifth shot that came in frame 328, frame 328. We found that out when I was in Washington. And the reason we found it out was that the 328 issue arose because there were several things that happened, but we didn't know if there was a shot for it. There were fragment issues. The first two issues were, we found out from watching the film 100 times that one of these fracture issues on frame 328 has an enlargement of the wound that occurred, and not at 328, but occurred at 313. That wound opened up the area above his right ear, and it flapped down. It also moved JFK's head forward because that was the shot that hit him in the top. There's a shot that was unaccounted for by the government. It hit him in the top of the head here. And then the third thing it did was it damaged the interior of the windshield to the left of the rear view. And it then struck Connolly in the wrist, ultimately. And that's how we know that Connolly then drops the Stetson. So we had to find out, and lo and behold, at 328, we found the frame that it referred to all this, that had the flare at 328 of what I was talking about here. Another problem arose, which I think you'll get a kick out of here. It's sad that we had to go through all this to get to the truth here. In December of 63, the Secret Service and the FBI, December of 63, the Secret Service and the FBI found that Connolly and JFK were struck by two separate bullets. Both were shot within 1.9 seconds of each other, between 1.9 seconds of each other. Well, the manual bolt action we know to get that rifle cocked takes 2.3 seconds. So therefore, we know beyond any and all doubt, officially, scientifically, from practice, that we couldn't have two successive shots coming from the alleged murder weapon because they were hit within 1.9 seconds. And the fastest you can get that shot off in the Malika Calcano is 2.3 seconds. So now we're confronted with the issue. Guess what? The Malika Calcano is not the only rifle used in this case. So what do we have here? We have an issue of critical importance, which we don't have people talking about enough. And it's from Dr. Robert Shaw, who was the thoracic surgeon for Governor Connolly. And Robert Shaw, you know, as we see all the time from the experts, particularly medical, they'll always have a recording machine because they want to know if you come on the case, you listen to that recording machine, you could pick it right up. It's all for the benefit of disclosure, accurate disclosure. And Shaw was talking into his microphone and he said, there's a 27 degree declination of the wound, entry wound, into the back of Connolly. And that being the case, why do I mention it? Because the 27-degree declination from the rooftop of the county records building in the northeast area of Houston Street and Elm, in that area, and in the depository, the county records rooftop has a direct shot down Elm. And guess what? It's a 27 degree declination.
Huh.
There you have it. I mean, you want to talk about evidence in a case. Don't ever get scared by someone who's telling you this thing was made up or anything else. The evidence is overwhelming. I'll tell you something else. When people say, well, maybe they were naive. What they did in this case, the CIA, which shows that the government knowingly contrived a predetermined conclusion through the pretense of an investigation. It was a phony probe. And both the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee on Assassinations disregarded all convincing and trustworthy evidence. That's what happened in this case. And the more you go through it, the more you see and realize the necessity of continuing forward in this thing. There are so many good people out there, just like the people who proved beyond any and all doubt, to my satisfaction, of the legitimacy of the McCone letter. They're out there, and they would be fascinated to get involved, finally, because this 80,000-page distribution that we heard about a week or two ago, you know, it is about as meaningful as the price of soybeans in Sitka, Alaska. You think after 62 years of deceit that the CIA would have anything in those 80,000 pages?
This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. They found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern you can think of. Best of all, not only is every product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you can get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches the mood you're looking for. 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK.
On the CIA, I have a few really, really specific questions I'd love to get answered if I could. This is back to the HSCA. So we covered on the podcast last season Oswald's alleged trip to Mexico City. And part of that saga was David Atlee Phillips being caught in a lie to the HSCA. And I understand you were the one who actually subpoenaed and interviewed Phillips about those tapes. And
as did Richard Sprague. Richard Sprague did it in December.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So, but I was going to say, I learned from your book that, you know, when Phillips was testifying, you talked about, you gave him the Hoover memo. And then this Hoover memo talking about how all the FBI agents in Dallas heard the Mexico City tape of Oswald, which proved that Phillips was lying, that the tape had been erased. And then Phillips read the memo, folded it, put it in his jacket, and left the hearing. That is a wild scene. Can you just tell me a little more about that?
Well, what happened was Dick Sprague, as a result of working with him, I came to realize pretty quickly he's an extraordinary human being, brilliant, and his integrity knew no. There was nothing in that integrity issue about him that in any way would do anything other than further his reputation positively. And he called in Phillips, but he didn't have the memo from J. Edgar Hoover. The J. Edgar Hoover memo was dated November 23rd. And in it, Hoover sent it out to all supervisory personnel in the service. And it said that our agents who had been questioning Oswald for 17 hours have come to the and have listened to the tape made of Phillips that the voice on the tape is not the voice of Lee Harvey Oswald. So someone else was involved in this whole thing on the October 1st tape. You can go on and on with the lies here. The October 1st issue was that a phony says his name was Lee Henry Oswald. And he's talking to various people, some of whom were assassins, known assassins in Mexico City and so on and so forth. And the CIA never corrected it. They knew that he was lying. They knew his name wasn't Lee Henry Oswald. And why would Oswald be a suspect 7 weeks before the assassination? That's the issue here. Why did they know that allegedly? So what happened was, when I got the memo, I immediately told the committee that I wanted to recall Phillips. And I had already spoken to Phillips before we got the memo. But when I had the memo, I wanted to make sure, he was aware now of what his lie was about. That's when I came to realize, in large measure, by the way, from the reaction of many of the congressmen, it was getting too hot for him. Before I put on Phillips, the bottom line was that I want to say, this is a congressman on the committee, before Mr. Tannenbaum speaks to anybody, and the way I ran the hearings were, I would, tell the committee beforehand what the issue was, how we would probe through it. If you had any legitimate questions, please let me know, and you'll ask them. And I said to the chairman of the committee, Lou Stokes, a very good man. He was like the leading defense attorney in Cleveland. And his brother, Carl Stokes, who was the first black mayor of Cleveland, got his brother Lou to run so that they could get that money and, hopefully use it for purposes of schools, education, infrastructure, all the good things. And I said to Lou, and we remained friendly throughout his life after this, I said, "Lou, I'm getting bad vibes from members of your colleagues." He didn't say anything. He stared at me, which surprised me. And I said, "What's going on?" He said, "They're not going to grant you your subpoena power." I said, "Why'd you hire me?" Sprague and I said, "You shouldn't hire us, as a matter of fact, because we're never going to compromise on search for truth. Congress can't work without compromise. That's why we mentioned it, and we did not want it to be political." "And you agreed?" He said, "Bob, the senior staff, the majority membership of this committee, never thought you would get to this bloody mess so quickly, if at all." So I just stared at him. I was stunned again here. And we stared at each other. He said, "Well, what do you want to do now?" And I said, "I resign effective immediately, and I'll be speaking to Sprague within an hour." So, yeah, I mean, the whole thing with Phillips, by the way, the notion is that I did an order. This is what goes on in the minds of people who are empty-headed. I never ordered any of the transcripts of anyone I spoke to. I had no reason to. I wasn't trying a case here so I would have the document kind of thing. They were there. Take a look at them. So I was, it, that meeting never happened, I want you to know, because somehow or other, nobody could find the transcript of that meeting that I had with Phillips. Oh, Sprague is there. There's exactly the same thing. Dick asked him. But he didn't have the comeback because we didn't find it yet. And it was prior to our really getting set up. We got set up and moved on January 1, 77. Dick did this in 76. And that's why, as soon as we had it, we had to go back to him and ask him, "What the heck is going on with you?" And we did that. And you're right. He folded it up. He didn't say a word. He walked out.
Wow.
That was how they reacted to the concerns of the people of this country.
You talked about Congressman Stokes, and it kind of sounds like most of the committee members were afraid of the CIA. My question is, were there any who were staunchly pro CIA who you could tell were sort of trying to stifle what you were doing? Or was it more that they just quietly didn't want to support what you were doing?
Oh, no, no. This was open and notorious to the extent that they wanted a cover for Phillips. And given that memo from J. Edgar Hoover, they were in hot water on this thing. The JFK, the Hoover document, is a clear lie that Phillips gave under oath. Don't believe me, believe Sprague. And Sprague got it. He didn't even know that we had the other memo. We didn't have it yet. That's the memo of J. Edgar Hoover of November 23rd. And that memo, of course, was the memo that said that, you know, he had the opportunity, he, Phillips, you know, lied about what we were talking about here. And you know, he lied on the page 37 issue. There were so many issues that he lied about, but he lied about what was going on with respect to the committee and what it was happening when he knew otherwise. So that's why when he folds up the memo that I gave him, because he said that this was proof that what he had said to the committee was an overt lie, and he had nothing to say. He just walked out.
A few more questions here on the HSCA. So in your role as deputy chief counsel, you hired some big names in, you know, the JFK assassination research world to be on the HSCA. I just wanted to throw a few of those names out at you. Here, I'll just go ahead and give them all to you at the same time. Gayton Fonzie, Dr. Michael Bodden, and Dr. Cyril Wecht. If you could just comment on kind of what your relationship was like with them and your
Mike Bodden was chief assistant medical examiner in New York. And he ultimately became chief medical examiner when the chief medical examiner passed away. And I worked with him, I would say once a week for a couple of years, going over cause and manner of death on autopsies in my murder cases. He was an expert without question. He had issues about wanting to always get ink. You know, when I say that, you know what I mean. He wanted ink. He wanted to be on the front page. And sometimes he would form his opinions that were totally contrary to common sense. And so I would go over that very carefully with him and straighten him out without question. We're not doing here. We're not running for office here. You know, show wounds that were on the arms. Were they wounds of lunging or they were wounds of defense? You know, don't tell me that because he had it here, you come up with one side on this thing. You don't know the answer to that. That was just an example of what I'm talking about.
Sure, sure.
So Cyril Wecht, I pay special tribute to in the book because he lived and ate and breathed before anyone ever was really into this whole thing. He deserved to be acknowledged. And I put in the letter, my letter of condolence and prayers to his wife and family, Sigrid and his family, indicating that he was the man for all seasons here. And the third person you mentioned to me was, we had Bodden, Cyril.
Gayton Fonzie?
Oh, Gayton. Phenomenal investigator. He worked for Sprague, interestingly enough, in Philadelphia. So I assigned him to Miami, and he did great work. To the extent that DeMaurinschild was someone, George DeMaurinschild was someone of very important interest to me and to the committee, to the investigation. And I gave him a subpoena to serve on DeMaurinschild, who was then living in South Florida, and he did. And then I got a call from the DA in that county where DeMaurinschild was residing, and he said, I wanted to report to you that DeMaurinschild just killed himself. He just got the subpoena. I wanted to talk to DeMaurinschild about all of the information he had, about all of the conservative characters who played this off politically, period. You, no matter who you're working with, friend or foe or anyone, you want to hold them to the standard of accuracy and common sense and potential cross-examination so that this is not some individual quest at all. It's all about dealing with trying to let the public know what happened And I believe that with Sprague, who became like a 46-year friend of mine after this, we tried cases all over the country together. And it's the example I gave you, you know, about public service. When we started, wasn't it fortunate for me to have been befriended by Sprague? And otherwise, I never would have had that experience. To be here talking to you is important because you are getting the message out. And that's what's so important. Any way you see fit to do that. So I thank you for that. It's very important. And
Thank you. I just have a few more questions here, real quick. I have four questions. We'll keep it as fast as I can here. So I've read that you saw films during your time on the HSCA that showed Lee Harvey Oswald with David Phillips and Guy Bannister at a Cuban exile training camp, and that you brought people in, witnesses who knew them to identify their faces on the film. And of course, this is against the official story because Oswald's supposed to be the enemy of Cuban exiles. He's supposed to be Mr. Pro Castro. The film, of course, disappeared at some point. Could you speak to that or just confirm that that happened?
Well, yeah, what happened was I was shown a film. I believe it was in the library at Georgetown. And it was like an 8 millimeter, 16 millimeter, I'm not sure. And in it were the people you just mentioned. There was the flight, the military, the militarist character, whose name you know, is a well-known guy. He's part of the whole
David
world
Perry.
of the underworld of people who are involved in militias in the country and all that kind of nonsense.
David Perry.
Yeah, there it is. But the film was important because Oswald is walking around with David Phillips, but Phillips was going by his nom de guerre, Bishop. And that's what I was able to prove in Washington, that Bishop was the nom de guerre of Phillips. Because Oswald, thank you raise a great question here. Because Oswald was involved with Maurice Bishop. First of all, why would this guy have a nom de guerre anyway? What's he hiding from here? And it was important because Mr. David Phillips, whatever name you want to use him by, was involved with people he had no business being involved with. And that was just another example of it. So when we came down one night early in the morning, it dawned on me that the bishop, this whole bishop thing, was a chess maneuver, believe it or not. You know how you figure all these things out and you check the records of where Bishop was and where Oswald, and you know, and they're there. It's been there in front of you, and then bango, you slide right into it. So I was very concerned about Mr. Phillips and the Mr. Bishop, call him who you want or whatever. But that added to the whole aspect of what was going on with this case. Because I'll tell you one last thing is that the material I asked Stokes for that Lou said that they're not going to give you the subpoenas. One was because we had information that the CIA itself had information written down in memo form that I was trying to get that indicated that the CIA was involved in the assassination. The other subpoena was it a rogue operation or was it an official operation? And that's what they wouldn't give me. And that's when he told me this thing basically is going to fold up now because I know what you're going to do. He knew I would resign. He knew me. And that was it. By the way, I'm glad we got to Bishop. I'm glad we got into the Bishop stuff. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Okay. And then there's a man named George Joannides who's become very famous recently because Jefferson Morley's pretty focused on bringing him to light. And he pretty much was the CIA liaison for the HSCA who was kind of running interference. And oh, it turns out that Carlos Bringer and these guys in New Orleans were actually reporting to him. To Joannides the whole time, and he said he didn't know have any involvement in the case. So did you have any interactions with Joannides, or was that after you?
No, I didn't. Once we left, I did not get involved with Giannini's. I didn't get involved with everyone else who were CIA known operatives who were running this investigation now. It created a total sham because of the obvious interfacing and involvement that an executive intelligence agency, unelected officials, were running the goddamn country.
Right. Yeah. One last question, and thanks again for your time today. Where do you think we go from here? Do you think the answer is, you know, another congressional investigation, or is it just another cultural touch point like Oliver Stone's movie was in the early 90s? Or what do we do to get the American people to see the information that's now clear that certainly it wasn't Oswald alone, to anybody who's really studied it, with the exception of the few people who are predisposed to believe that it was Oswald alone, no matter how much they look at it?
No, that's a good question, because Oliver Stone, and I put aside the politics of all these people, I'm interested in what they did about this case. He was responsible, I believe, for the JFK Records Act of 1992. Because in 91, the movie came out, and he has an amazing, he's to be credited, in my judgment, for putting out so much evidence. It's hard to process it in one sitting. Sure, I can do it because I spent all this time investigating it. You're an expert in it. You know what you've read. You've dealt with these issues. But in 1993, the Assassination Records Review Board was formed as a result of the 92 Records Act, the JFK Records. And I testified before the 93 Assassination Record Review Board and said, give over all of the evidence. There's nothing in here that in any way is going to embarrass or jeopardize national security. And if there are, we'll have hearings, in-camera hearings before a judge. And let him say, Mr. Tannenbaum, no, in all fairness, you want to be fair, we don't think this should be divulged at this moment. Thank you. Let's go on to the next one. That's why this is so important to be done in that fashion. Now, what should happen now? The President of the United States has finally ordered the release. He did this in his first term, and now he's doing it again, or has done it again. I haven't read all 80,000, believe me. I'm not a speed reader here. But the bottom line is that we know from all the issues that I raised with you that there are very serious people out there who can help us get to the truth. That's all we're interested in. And let the American people know it, period. And I just think that, and that's why I say, you know, the 93 Assassinations Record Review Board, because the district court judge who spoke to me about this appeared to be a very decent guy. I think he was from Minneapolis. And he told me about his interest in this whole thing. It was strictly top of the line as far as I was concerned. And that's why I testified. It's all on the record. All this stuff is on the record. So again, I thank you for letting us go through this exercise. And it's no simple task because there's so many different avenues and doors that open. Also, from our investigation, I'll quickly say LBJ was not responsible for the assassination of President Kennedy. The mafia, which was created by one of the senior staff members after we left, came out with a book about the mafia. It was ridiculous. He's a person who never tried a case or investigated a case in his life. And he's getting his teeth chimed in on this case of all cases. So I do think that it's very important for people like yourself to get together with your colleagues, and you've been through this a lot, and make a recommendation to the president. Because what Trump did say was interesting to me, was people said to him, who were very good people, they said to him after in his first term, why didn't you turn it over? You said you would. And he said, if you saw what I saw, you wouldn't have turned it over either. Well, that's what we want to see. American people can handle the truth. I mean, this is ridiculous. Can't handle the truth. Who can handle it? There are certain people getting shot with gold in their veins. Oh, you can now handle the truth.
Well, yeah, there's about 1,000 or so documents still remaining to be declassified, but the National Archives has told Jefferson Morley as recently as last week that they are all forthcoming and they're scanning them in. So, hopefully that continues to be the case. Again, thank you so much for your time today. It was great talking to you. For all the listeners here on Solving JFK, we'll be back with the second half of the series on Lyndon Johnson starting next week.